All right, what I want to do here, a little bit experimental, but I think it's better than me just trying to barrel through all the information. And we did try to get a little more ventilation here and do the best we can. Lots of material on the identity of Jesus and the resurrection. But what I want to do is divide this into, well, several categories. The first category would be the identity of Jesus. Who he said he was and how we should interpret this. Second would be the significance of the resurrection and the event of the resurrection. And let's call the third from Christ to Christianity. That is relating Christ to Christian doctrines. And I think we have about eight rows. Let's see. This row is not too many people. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I think it's 8 rows. And I want to divide it up into, what did I have, 3 sections, 4 sections? And maybe, now not everybody can converge the way the class is, but what I want you to do is just turn to a few people next to you within these sections to strategize a little bit in how you would present this to someone who is asking you questions. And I will go roughly from the outline. Okay? So, you know, if we could have maybe the first 2 rows, and if you get just in a couple of groups, 2 or 3 groups, talk about how you're going to strategize talking to an unbeliever about the identity of Jesus. That would be the first 2 rows. Actually, let's make it the first 3 because there are only 3 people in this row. And the next 2 rows, if you could talk about presenting the significance and meaning of the resurrection of Jesus. Actually, what did I say? We've got 3. Yeah, the next 3 rows, the resurrection, and the last ones, from Christ to Christianity, that is, if we have these arguments, reliability of Scripture and the identity of Jesus, how do you get to these doctrines of sin, the cross, faith, righteousness, the canonicity of the Bible? Are you with me on this? So the first 3 would be identity of Jesus, the next 3, the resurrection, the rest would be on from Christ to Christianity. All right, let's start with the first group. About the identity of Jesus. Who is Jesus? And I know you've had different groups, but you've all been, the first 3 rows are working on the identity of Jesus, some basic questions, issues there. All right? So I think the way we'll do it, you'll probably get about 10 minutes for each group, roughly. So I will just become Doug Unbeliever. And I'll just give you a couple of introductory questions, all right, about the identity of Jesus. I'll just call on you and we'll see where we go with this. Okay, I'm interested in Jesus. I think Jesus is a fascinating person. I can't deny that he is of tremendous importance historically, globally, with so many hundreds of millions of Christians throughout centuries. So I am not hostile to Jesus. I don't hold that he didn't exist, the way some have argued. And I realize now that there are some interesting perspectives on the New Testament that I'd like to look into it. I'd like to know more about it. I don't know much. I went to Sunday school for a few years and seen a couple of videos about Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls and some stuff like that. I don't remember all the details. But what I would like to know is, first of all, before you maybe talk about what Jesus said or did, why is it important that I believe certain things about Jesus? Because Christians are always going around trying to get you, I think, to believe in Jesus. Or they say things like, ask Jesus into your heart. And I know people believe different things about Jesus. People have different beliefs about other religious figures, Buddha, Muhammad, Confucius, Lao Tzu, Jerry Garcia. And others. And I'm just wondering, what is it that Christians want non-Christians to think about Jesus? What's the significance of it? I mean, I basically have a favorable view of Jesus right now. I do not know a tremendous amount, but I have a very favorable view of him. So why is this an issue to you as Christians? Significance of Jesus. The importance of the question. Why is it important? First 3 rows. If you just completely bail out, I'll go to the other rows. I mean, yes.
Well, first of all, given what I believe about Jesus Christ, I would open communication. If from what I know and believe about Jesus Christ, having this conversation right here fits well into the way he lived and the way he did things. He spent a lot of time with people, just like you and me, hanging out, talking about the meaning of things. And so this conversation fits well.
Okay. So you're trying to be like Jesus in discussing who Jesus is. But the question is, what's so important about it? I mean, people believe in some way in Buddha, you believe in Jesus. How does this fit? I want to sort of get off the ground with this. Dan, do you have comments?
Yeah, I was going to say, from a Christian tradition, there's salvific implications.
Maybe it's salvific. Is that a salad dressing?
There's implications about life after death connected to trust and belief in this person Christ. So it's not just, well, he did some good works, that's neat, but there's a faith and trust in the life of Jesus, his death, his burial, and resurrection that has consequences for life. So life and death situations, but heaven and hell.
Okay, so you're saying that the life and death and resurrection of Jesus has tremendous significance. I grant that because I realize he's probably the most significant, influential person in the history of the world. I grant that much. Now, how does that relate to heaven and hell? I mean, is that all it is? You believe somehow in Jesus to go to heaven and avoid hell? Is that sort of all there is to it? First three rows. Yeah.
The belief that Jesus was not just a man, but that he was the revealed person of God. That he was the Son of God who came down from heaven to repair the relationship that was broken between God and his creation as man. Made in his image. And he wanted to restore that relationship, and so he revealed himself through the person of his Son, Jesus Christ, who lived a perfect life, and in that way was able to atone for the mess ups that we humans personally make daily. So that if we believe in that sacrifice and in his resurrection, that we too could have that prepared relationship with him.
Okay, so belief is somehow related to a right relationship with God. So what exactly... Well, first of all, I guess I have to ask, what is it that Jesus claimed about himself? All right, I need to believe somehow in Jesus to have salvation, to have the right salvific salad dressing. These theological terms, I don't use these terms, so you have to sort of use more common sense language with me, common parlance. So I should believe. Yeah, right. All right, I'm supposed to believe in Jesus because somehow he can set me right with God. Now, what is it about him, or what did he say about himself? I know he's important, significant. Christians revere him. What exactly did he say about himself? I mean, I know he gave the golden rule. I know he told us to love our enemies. I know he influenced a lot of people who weren't even Christians, like Mohandas Gandhi, with his ethic. So it seems like you can sort of resonate with Jesus without a lot of hardcore beliefs about who he said he was, or who did he say he was, basically.
Jesus himself said that he was God. In John's Gospel, he equates himself with God when he says, "I and the Father," which is a reference to God the Father, "are one." One meaning there, one in essence, one in being.
Where exactly is that in John? You Christians disagree about where these statements are in the Bible. Well, anyway, I like to go and read that. So where is that? John 10? Okay, John 10:30. What does that mean, by the way, 10:30? It's 10 to 9, actually.
10:30 is the chapter.
Okay. Okay, I see that guy at those games holding up, John 3:16. I always thought his watch was stuck. I really didn't know what that was. All right, so he says, "I am one with the Father." So there are two gods? There's God the Father and Jesus?
No, what Jesus is saying there is that he and the Father are one in essence. And really what I guess what we're getting
Well, I've heard of it. Is it important for me to know that?
I think so. I think it's also important to know what else Jesus said about himself.
Okay, before we get to the Trinity, why don't we get to other things he said about himself? Because I know he said, love your neighbor, turn the other cheek. Everybody knows that. But what has he said about himself that makes him so different? I mean, from, let's say, Buddha or Muhammad or something. Yes.
When Jesus was standing before Pilate on his trial, and this is in John, the same book, chapter 18, verse 36. My kingdom is out of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place. And then Pilate says, you are a king then. And Jesus answered, you are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born. And for this I came into the world to testify the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me. So Jesus here is claiming to be a king. And it's not a king of this world.
Okay. He's a king. He's revered. How does that relate to what Christians keep saying about believing in him or believing on him or something of that nature? I mean, what exactly did he do? He's a king. He taught these ethical principles. Yeah.
Well, he's shown a strong interest in the truth and finding out what's right and what's true. I think one important aspect that sets Jesus apart from makes him very important when you're looking at truth is that he exclusively claims that he came to reveal the truth and that and his claim is exclusive. You won't find the truth outside of him and what he says and what's revealed.
So there's nothing true. Let me just get clear about this. There's nothing true in any other religion, so everything Buddha said was false. Everything Muhammad said was false. Everything Confucius said was false. Sir?
The worldview that they support with their truth claims are end up being false in your search for truth.
Well, I was looking at this book recently called Jesus and Buddha, edited by Marcus Borg. That was kind of interesting. Most of the book is just one line on one page and one line on another page. It's kind of a quick read. And you can find really parallel sayings between Jesus and Buddha, like loving your enemies and doing unto others. They're very similar on ethics, being humble. Now, but you're saying Jesus is the truth and there's no other truth anywhere else, all other worldviews are completely false? So everything Buddha said was false? Even where he seems to agree with Jesus?
If you look at Buddha's overall view, context of what he's saying in his worldview, then what he is saying is not consistent with the rest of his worldview. And so, although his statement may have some truth to it, Jesus proclaims that he is the revelation of truth.
Okay, well, you know, we don't need...
When you search for truth, I think it's valuable to look at what Jesus said in that he claims to be the truth.
Okay, now where does he claim to be the truth? Where in the Bible?
In John 14:6.
Okay. What does that say? Has anyone memorized that? Some Christians, at least years ago, used to memorize the Bible. Yeah?
Jesus claimed that he was the way, the truth, and the life, and that he was the only way. So ultimately,
believe
in him and what he did by coming to earth, dying for, and
okay. Okay, so he's the only way to God. Why believe that? I could claim that. I could claim I'm the only way to God. Someone else could. Some other leader could. Do you base your entire belief on Jesus on that one verse? Yes, Ralph?
Jesus something very powerful to demonstrate that he was God. And that was when he was dealing with someone who had a person, he said, forgive your sins. And people knew that that was what was being talked about when he said, on the only way to the Father. And in order to demonstrate that, he said, which is easier, forgive those sins or to heal those sins. And obviously there'd be no way for them to know, to validate the forgiveness. So he said, I'll heal him to prove that I couldn't be forgiven. And so he did.
And where is that in the Bible?
Mark chapter.
Good. I mean, I take your word for it. So you're saying that his miraculous power is related to his claims in some way? That he sort of demonstrated his veracity by his power? Okay, so you've got, it's the only way to the Father. He has authority to forgive sins. Is there anything else that differentiates him from Buddha, Muhammad, Confucius, Lao Tzu?
The biggest one is he rose from the dead.
That's the third row. But yeah, I've heard that before. We'll let the third row get to that. All the other ones are dead. So if he really did that, I would be very impressed, frankly, because there's no tradition of that with Muhammad or Buddha or Confucius or Lao Tzu. There's no tradition at all of it. They could say he lives on, their ideas live on, but no, I mean, that would be extremely impressive if you could give a good argument for that. But most of the Christians I hear talking about resurrection just say they know that they know it and they're knower. And then I talk to Buddhists and they say, I know the Buddha's the enlightened one because I meditate and I really don't know what to think. But, I mean, are there any other things you'd want to tell me about what Jesus said about himself to differentiate him from others? Any other claims? I mean, okay, he's making these claims, and there's a claim to miracle. But, you know, maybe he was a great ethical teacher, had some very profound things to say, but he was just a little confused about his own identity. You know, he made some claims about being the truth and being one with God, but maybe he got a little rambunctious metaphysically at that point. And we shouldn't really take him too seriously on that. I mean, that's an awfully strong claim to make. Yeah.
Well, I think that in some of our own experiences when, even people today that might claim to be God.
I know of some.
Yeah, when they do that, usually we don't trust what else they say, any of their other statements, whether they say that the Minnesota Vikings are the best football team, right? You might not believe that then if they claim to be God also. So I think you need to take those same judgments with Jesus, that if you're going to say that he was a good ethical teacher, but he also claimed to be God and wasn't, it doesn't really fit.
So what are the options then? Let's say he claimed to be God in human form, power to forgive sins, worked miracles. What are the options then for him? Okay, Lord, lunatic, or liar? I've heard that before somewhere. Aren't there some other options? I mean, what about legend? You know, I said earlier I was interested in the New Testament, so if I think it's generally reliable, I would rule out legend. But legend's a possibility if it's not reliable.
Well, we have to look at the historicity for the reliability of the New Testament as a historical document.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And we developed that. Developed it from that point that the New Testament is a historical document. And it can be proven from outside sources, the other guys that wrote it at the same time. And Christ, one of the big things is he made predictions about himself that then later became true. And that's almost equal to me with the resurrection story.
Okay, so you claim he had supernatural knowledge,
yeah.
Predictions that came, like what?
He claimed that he would rise from the dead
mm-hmm.
before the
mm-hmm.
happened.
Right, yeah.
And the verse that you brought, the guy's always in the info, the John 3:16, for God so loved the world, personal God, that he gave his only begotten son. The son is normally part of the same body or type or nature, part of the Trinity which we discussed a little earlier. Whosoever believes would not perish but have the same everlasting life.
Mm-hmm.
But that they always say that that's the nutshell of the gospel. If you have that verse, you have the whole thing of why we need a relationship with a personal God.
Okay, so you give me some things to think about here. Some unique claims of Jesus, some credentials of Jesus, some biblical concerns. That's good, that's important. and I've still got a lot of questions, but what would be the best thing for me to do to look into this? Where do I go from here? Yeah.
The best place, in my opinion, would be to look at your four books that come out of the New Testament. You may have seen The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, I read it. I thought it was cool. Yeah, it was very cool.
It's kind of popular to talk about the Gospels, what's called a synoptic gospel. What's cool about these Gospels, though, is if you really open them up and look at them, unlike maybe flipping through the channels and checking out the latest Jesus movie, when you actually look at these Gospels and read them for yourself, it smells like truth. As you go through there, you'll see time and time again things that they just don't work as legend or myth. They're just not beautiful enough. It feels like real life when you walk through those Gospels.
Okay, so I should read them. Should I read all of them? Should I start with anyone? Start with one? Okay. Well, that's good. Let me get to the next. Which one? Does it matter? I've heard of that one. You want me to read that? All right. Well, that's, you gave me some things to think about. That's good. Now, this came up earlier, the resurrection. So let's go to the next group. What exactly is this claim of resurrection? Now, a lot of religions teach belief in an afterlife. And some traditions of Buddhism believe that the Buddha lives on, but not in this realm, lives on in nirvana in some sense. So I'd like some clarification about what the significance of this claim of Jesus' resurrection is. What exactly does it mean? And then I'd like you to say why you believe it occurred, whatever you think it is. So what does it mean? Or how is it related to Christianity? Now, I was told earlier here that Jesus predicted it, that he would die and rise again. I guess that's in the Gospels. So, okay, he would die and rise again. What's so important about that? Yes? Well, you know, I've read these stories, I've heard of these stories that Jesus supposedly raised people from the dead, like Lazarus. So didn't they conquer death then, Lazarus? Okay. All right. So it's a sign of his victory over death. Is that somehow related to his own death? Why does that work? I mean, you know, you see so many symbols of the cross and people saying different things. You know, the Mel Gibson movie was all about the horrors of the path to the cross and so on, the passion. That's somehow related to the resurrection. I mean, is the resurrection the important thing and the cross not as important? I don't quite understand that. How does that work? Actually, we could go to the third level, too, because that was we had the cross in that section. Yeah?
Well, the resurrection is very important, and even more so than the cross, because the symbol of our being restored to our rightful place as creations under God, where our relationship with God is restored to the sacrifice.
Oh, yeah, sure. Somewhere along the line. Do I have to believe in a literal Adam and Eve to accept Jesus? I have a hard time believing that right now. I sort of think evolution is probably true. But I'm really interested in Jesus. I believe in a supernatural realm. Evolution seems pretty well established, given from what I've heard. I mean, is my belief in Jesus dependent on believing in a literal Adam and Eve?
Our belief is my belief, yes, because if you believe in the historical significance that God works through history and that's part of our history, and this is why we are in the state of which we're in, I think we need to believe in Him and believe in Him and the fall.
Well, I've heard there's some biblical scholars, theologians that believe in the fall, but don't believe in literal Adam and Eve. They believe we're estranged from God, but that just didn't happen with a specific literal couple. It happened at some point in evolution. You're telling me, you want me to believe in the resurrection, but now I have to believe in a literal Adam and Eve too?
I think you really need to take it as a whole package, and you can really dive into this, but I think what we really need to focus on is the fact that
can we bracket the evolution thing for a minute and just talk about the resurrection? I mean, this really happened. I'm open to a lot of new things. So,
what do you want to discuss?
Well, I'd like to discuss why you believe it occurred.
I believe it occurred because look at the natural tendencies of human beings. It really falls in line by the biblical descriptions of who we are. As
fallen
creatures. Does that make sense?
No. Okay. The resurrection fits into...
No, I'm talking about the
fall. The fall. I'm not on the resurrection. I'm asking you if we can bracket the historical fall and talk about this event. See, if you could show me that this event happened, there's good evidence for it, I'm open to a lot of other things. But right now, I'm just not all that open to junking the whole evolutionary thing.
Okay?
I want to see some evidence, and there's this woman with a red shirt next to you that would like to start talking. Yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Have you ever done anything wrong in your life? What have you felt bad about?
Yes. Who hasn't?
Okay. So, the Bible would call that, and in Romans 3, chapter 3, it says that the payment for sin is death. So, in order to understand the resurrection, now let me explain a little bit about what sin has to do with in the Old Testament, there was God established the law with Moses having to do with the Jewish people making sacrifices, sacrificed animals on altars, and this was like in place of their sin, not like to pay for their sin. They had to do these sacrifices. It was something over and over and over again that they had to do. It was a never ending thing. So it's how many times you have to sacrifice to cover up your sin was a never ending thing. So Jesus came, he was a sacrifice because he was a perfect sacrifice. It was no longer a lamb. Now it was a man, but a perfect man. He had no sin. He was fully God, he was fully man. And he was as a man, he was the final sacrifice. And so he died on that cross for the sin of the whole world as the final sacrifice. And he said it is finished, and he was on the cross and he died. But the difference between him and the other sacrifices is that he rose, as he predicted, 3 days later. And so conquering death and pain for
that makes some sense. I don't have all the details down, but it's a marvelous story. It's an inspiring story. I mean, that's a story within which many people have lived for centuries. But what I'm thinking of is reasons to believe it happened, the resurrection. Yes?
There are multiple arguments that
we made for the resurrection. Oh, wait a minute. Let me just get straight. Arguments. Every time I've ever talked to Christians about Jesus and the resurrection, they say, I have faith, and I've taken a leap of faith. And you think that this supernatural event can be supported through arguments?
Okay.
Isn't that kind of unspiritual?
It's not unspiritual because, honestly, any religion is dealing with worldview and dealing with truth claims. If you're going to believe those truth claims, you should be rational about why you believe those truth claims and you should be able to believe them logically.
Okay, I'll give it a try. So what are the reasons?
There's multiple reasons. There's some that are non-extraordinary. There's some that are definitely extraordinary. Extraordinary reasons include documented appearances of Jesus after the resurrection, which occurred both to individual people and large groups of people, and did not display hallucinatory characteristics, but that were, even when you compare to large groups of people who had individual interpretations of those experiences. So you can go from an extraordinary point like that, and you can also go from a non-extraordinary point like that. Very logically speaking, if you look at the historical evidence, both in the Bible and outside of the Bible, that the tomb itself was empty, and that Jesus was not, his body was not actually present in the tomb. At that time, the Jewish people was very much wanted to dwell and stop this Christian movement, and all they would have had to do was actually reduce Jesus' body without that movement, but they never did to use that body. In addition, at that time, tombs were generally venerated, people worshipped. No people actually worship the tomb of Jesus. The actual tomb to be identified because the tomb was from a very, very wealthy man, Joseph of Arimathea, and it would have been commonly known where the tomb was, so the tomb was hidden. There were guards in front of the tomb, and there were Roman guards, and some people may say they were bribed and took the body out. However, at that time, for Roman soldiers who have been guarding a tomb and or a prison and have lost or whoever was in it, they would have been killed. So there's very little evidence that they would have survived. So the evidence keeps stacking upon itself until, logically, as a best explanation for the empty tomb, you know, Jesus' actual sentence.
I've never heard any of that before. I've even been to a couple of sermons on Easter. I never heard any of that. That's very interesting. Is there anything else? Any other evidence? Very interesting arguments. Yes?
It's also worth noting that biblical accounts in the Gospels cite that their first witness to the resurrected body was a female. And you should know that in that time, females didn't have a lot of credibility in court. They couldn't vote. And so if the writers were going to...
Did anybody vote during that time?
So if you're gonna, I think if they're gonna embellish a story that was supposed to be, you know, real solid and believable, I don't think they would have used such an unlikely first witness to his resurrected body. And you can also look at the fact that those that he taught in person were martyred, which is not the same as people dying for something they believe in. This is where these people were put to death because they would not renounce his resurrection. These were people that were not geographically near one another. You know, all they would have to do is announce their faith, announce the resurrection, and they could have lived. But they died because I believe that they had faith because Christ proved to them that they could cross over from death to life. So they had no fear of death because they knew that their Lord and Savior had conquered it, and they knew they would too.
How does that differ from the 19 hijackers on September 11th who were absolutely certain they would go to paradise and have 72 maidens waiting on them? They died for what they took to be true?
That's a good question. Those guys killed themselves. They did it by choice. These martyrs had the choice to live by renouncing something, but you know, can you imagine somebody dying for something that they knew was a lie?
You're saying that would be the situation with these early Christians? They would know it was a lie if they died for it? How's that work?
Because I'm talking about the disciples.
Okay.
They were eyewitnesses to his resurrection. They saw him physically, and most of them were martyred, all of them at once. So they could have chosen, if it weren't true, they could have chosen to renounce him to save their own lives. They didn't do that. That's how absolutely possible.
Okay. So you're not saying nobody dies for a lie. Actually, I've heard some Christians say that, and I never was very convinced by it. You're saying nobody pays the ultimate price for something they know is a lie. If they have nothing...
Lies all the time. They haven't gave people guys to lie.
Yeah, okay.
But these guys knew it wasn't a lie.
Okay.
So you might want to think about that. You know, why would they do that?
Right. Right. Interesting. Anything else about the resurrection you'd like to bring up? Yes?
I think something else that's probably significant is that there are sources that are extra-biblical, in other words, outside of the Bible. I think a lot of people look at the Bible and say, well, that's simply a holy book. Your faith specifically, and maybe not be reliable in the experience of answering others' verbal documents, not
property. Probably one of the more famous ones in tropical Florida is quoted as the Cephas Flavius, who was basically a Jew and a historian for Roman time. And he wrote, and he made reference to Jesus, and he made reference to Jesus' death and also his resurrection.
But he wasn't a Christian, though, was he? That kind of weird believing in the resurrection of Christ, not being a Christian? That document is a little bit controversial, though. Some people think the church added certain sections to it at a later point. So why should I believe it at all?
That's a good question.
All right. That's a decent answer. Anybody else? Can anybody else jam on Josephus for a second? Your hands immediately go down. Paul can. Paul, what do you think? Interpolation? Tell me what that means.
That Christians generally are the ones propagating the words of Josephus and granted to the Jews and a lot of people are still Christians. It's quite likely that Christians are the ones that added that passage. It seems far more likely that Josephus actually wrote something about Christ. Scholars have analyzed that and said, yes, it does believe on Josephus. Maybe some of it's being embellished.
That makes me really wonder how they would pass down their own scriptures if they do that to Josephus. I'll have to look into that more. All right, I know we're just about out of time. I want somebody to tell me one thing, though, if you can do this in a nutshell. I don't know. But it seems to me there's a lot of controversy about the real Bible. Like I see these books, the lost books of the Bible, or other gospels. Elaine Pagels talks about these other gospels, and I've heard basically that all these Gospels were floating around, and it was only basically at a later church council that the church sort of authoritatively said, these are in and these are out. And there are a lot of people saying the ones that are not in our Bibles, the Protestant Catholic Bibles, I guess, are just as legitimate. And I just wonder, where does somebody like me who's not in the church, doesn't have much background about this, where do I go? I mean, how do I know which ones are the most reliable? Is there anything you can tell me about that? I mean, why these books were included? Is there any sort of short, basic answer that you could give that would point me in the right direction? I mean, I'm willing to look at these books as reliable. They seem to have some evidence of reliability, but I know there are these other, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary, all these things. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Other gospels like the Gospel of Thomas and other things like the Gospel of Mary and several other ones, the other books of the Bible, they looked at those and they found them to be, inerrant.
Inerrant?
Well,
they had no errors? Then why did they throw them out?
Totally inerrant. Sorry, wrong word.
You mean in error?
In error.
Okay.
Certain parts, not inerrant. Sorry. So they believe the Tabitha, who was a very long prophet, and it was.
Okay. So I just want to get clear on this. And when somebody gives me this answer, you can go.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be you. Are you saying there were specific principles that they employed to select the books? What exactly were those principles? I need a third section because I haven't given you enough of a hard time. Yes? There were a bunch of hands.
Was it used in reading in other church meetings for a longer section of time?
Public reading. So you're saying it's not that there were all these equally legitimate books and then artificially some council, that they had some reasoning behind it. There were some principles that were employed for it. So So I can have some confidence that the books that are actually in the New Testament are there for some reasons that could hold up historically. I mean, that sounds good if you could back it up. There's so much out there, it's really hard to know what's authoritative, what makes sense. Okay, we're over time. We'll come out of the character. You know, we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants when you do this, and it's a little hard to organize it all. But basically what I wanted to do, let me just debrief just for 1 second, is use terms that a non-Christian will understand. So whenever you use in terms like interpolation, salvific, I'm not going to know what those mean. Because remember, I'm trying to be a thoughtful but not super theologically astute person. And then you have to try to use language and concepts that people can understand and don't take a lot for granted. Of course, this is all a very artificial situation. And realize that if you really start to present apologetic arguments, many non-Christians, and I did this with Carrie, have never heard this before. And it may startle them. It may be a kind of a new model for looking at faith issues. So you have to kind of work with people to get over that shock. I mean, Carrie, you were saying that your friend last night that came to my lecture had never heard Christianity presented in kind of a logical, rational, non-preachy way. The first time. Ever? Or?
Ever.
And how old is he? 28?
29?
So you're dealing with folks that have maybe never heard this kind of approach before. So you have to be patient. Go with their knowledge. Go with their ignorance. And one last thing. You don't have to prove everything. That's why I jumped on you. You don't have to prove everything in an investigative discussion. So if I don't know what I think about evolution or I'm really committed to it, but I'm interested in Jesus, I believe in kind of the general reliability of the Bible, and I'm open to arguments for the resurrection, then just bracket the question of the historicity of Adam and Eve, because there are people who believe we're fallen and we need Christ as Savior who don't believe in a literal Adam and Eve. Now, I think they're wrong. But the issue fundamentally is, do I need a Savior to atone for my sin? I do. So whatever Adam and Eve were, we can sort of deal with that a little bit later. So you want to try to move things as best you can to the reality of Christ, the reality of the cross, the resurrection, that we have an authoritative standard to know these things by the Scripture, and the significance of this, the importance of this, because it's very significant to us, the cross, the resurrection, and so on, the ascension, the second coming. We see, or I hope we see, how this fits into a theology, into a worldview. The non-Christian does not. They're just dealing with bits and pieces. They've heard these terms. They've seen images. It's not a unified whole in their mind. So you have to try to tell the story and relate the concepts in a way that's integrated. All right?